Welcome to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. This episode is part of our special series on how the arts and culture sector is coming back from the COVID-19 pandemic and features voices from the Arts for a Better Bay Area State of the Arts Summit, which was focused on rebuilding our communities through the arts.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Just waiting for folks to wander back in from the break. As all live events, it's kind of a series of control chaos, and we're running a few moments late and trying to use everyone's time well. So our first session, as I mentioned earlier, is the economic recovery of arts organizations. So we tried to put together a panel discussion today with a statewide context, with a data specialist, if you will, someone who's really concentrated on the data out there and how the marketplace has changed over the last 3 years of the pandemic. And then with art organizations, you know, in the house, who are really working with artists and an organization that's out and it's done a wonderful experiment with a universal basic income for artists. So with that, I'm going to start with having each participant introduce themselves and their organization, and then we'll circle back and go to that speaker and have that speaker talk about what they and their organization are doing to economically recover, if you will, the arts and culture sector. So I'm going to start off with Julie Baker from Californians for the Arts.
Wait, you just did my introduction. So I'm Julie Baker. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I'm the CEO of Californians for the Arts and California Arts Advocates, because we have a C3 and a C4, just because, you know, it's fun to be a CEO of two organizations. And what we do is the C4 is a lobbying organization, so we really try to influence the legislature and the administration to invest in the creative workforce. We work closely with Director Moscone and others in the state, including small business. We really look at how do we infiltrate and integrate into other state agencies, and because there's a lot more money in places and the creative workforce is integral and essential to solving these problems. And our job is to, essentially, I'm a salesperson. I spend my day trying to persuade the legislature and the administration to recognize and value and invest in the creative workforce. And the C3 really works to build a network of folks to engage in advocacy and also provide technical assistance on grant programs. So hopefully some of you have been able to access some of the hundreds of millions of dollars that we collectively lobbied for relief funds. So I'll just stop there. I'm also former Performing Arts Center director, gallery owner. Let's see, I went to the Phoenix hotel thing that Maria Jensen did 100 years ago, and I'm staying there tonight. It's super fun. And I'm a grandmother and a mother of three boys, and I live in Nevada City, California.
Hi, I'm Jenny Cohn. I am a data analyst with TRG Arts. If you're not familiar with TRG, we're a arts marketing consulting firm, but we have really two arms of the organization. We have the data analyst side, and then we have the consulting side. And during the pandemic, all departments got together and created what we called the Arts and Culture Dashboard, which collects data daily through a special DDX from 450 organizations around the world in all different sizes and scales and genres of the performing arts. And then we get to look at that data and tell stories with it to help all of you and our clients grow and recover better. So we'll get into the actual in a minute.
Hello, everyone. I'm Vanessa Wilson. I'm here representing ArtsBan. I'm the deputy director there. ArtsBan is a nonprofit based here out of San Francisco, and we support San Francisco-based artists. We've been around since the 70s. Our biggest program that we're most widely known for is our flagship San Francisco Open Studios. It's an annual citywide program that mobilizes all of the city's artists to open their creative spaces to the public. But outside of that, we also do year-round programming to build connections between our artists here in the city and the city's residents and visitors. Our programming is quite extensive. We're a tiny staff, but we can get into the details a little later. It includes professional development and networking mixers and public art initiatives. We really do a lot to build connections between the creatives and the community here. We're very connection-based and community-oriented.
I'm Lauren McMadoo, and I recently joined Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, YBCA, as the head of external relations. I'm really excited to be there. YBCA is at the hub of the downtown area, and we are a space where we invite the community to really participate, create, engage in a variety of different multidisciplinary arts. And it's a space for really to build community, and that's one thing that we do. Not only do we support artists, we're really here for the community to provide a resource to them. My connection to the arts, I am a retired professional ballet dancer, and I dance with the Dance Theater Harlem in New York City. So I'm really excited to be with YBCA and really helping artists.
And I'm Kerry McClellan. I'm the new COO at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And come there through a long journey through theater, my own writing, and then arriving as a First Amendment lawyer on behalf of artists and journalists for the last several years. So very excited to be doing the same and advocating on behalf of Yerba Buena's works. I think we're at a moment where we're taking a step back after inheriting all the tremendous work John started there, some of which began in our neighborhood, and through the pandemic included significant experiments in guaranteed income as a way to model pandemic relief for artists. We've taken on additional work from re-granting from the California Arts Council, and all of that work's now at a place ripe enough where we can be stepping back soon and trying to draw some best practices from it. So I think we're a little earlier today than being able to actually speak to some of those, but it's an exciting moment where we can talk about some of the experiments today and how they've been useful, and maybe also talk about the ways they're informing our programming in the building and ways in which we see program integrally linked to these questions of livelihoods and the artist ecosystem.
Thank you. That was great. So as you can see, a pretty wide-ranging panel. So I'm going to circle back and have Julie kind of help us set the table as kind of on a statewide, because the arts economy throws billions of dollars to the California economy. And so I'm going to have Julie provide everyone just really some framework of what her and her team have been doing over the last 3 years when we went into 2020. And everyone knows in this room, we were, you know, everything was shut down, 90% unemployment in performing arts space, et cetera. So Julie, take it away and give us really, I know it's a big, long conversation.
But summarize 3 years in 5 minutes.
Right, 5 minutes. Because we're gonna open it up to Q&A afterwards. So, you know, you have done so much wonderful work, and I know it's hard to do in 5 minutes.
Hopefully, you know, many of you have experienced what we've been doing over the last 3 years. When I say we, I want to also shout out to some folks who are here. Ron Muriera, who is now with the city of San Jose, just termed off of our board and had been the board president for Californians for the Arts, and Rachel Osajima, who is on and is at the Alameda County Cultural Department, and she is had been on the board for 14 years. And this organization was largely volunteer-led for a very, very long time, and like many nonprofit organizations, and Maria Costa, are you in the room here? Maria Costa, also a very longtime board member, and so grateful for everyone who's done all of this work to get us to where we were. Obviously, 2020, before that AB5, maybe some of you have been impacted by the employment laws changing. We really had to engage to educate the legislature around what was happening to our workforce and what we needed to do to provide solutions to not only change that so for the better, but also to educate legislature, elected officials, the administration, on what artists and cultural bearers and arts organizations and the whole arts and culture sector can bring in terms of solutions. So we're not there saying, help us. We're saying we are here to help you. And you have underutilized this workforce forever. And why are you overlooking us? Because we can really help affect change. And you know, often when you're talking to an elected official, it is around jobs, right? You have to talk about the economic impact of what we do. And just some statistics. I mean, it's a $261 billion industry for the state of California. That's 7.7% of the gross domestic product of California. So we're not small. We're not ineffectual. This is ahead of agriculture. This is ahead of transportation, okay? So, I mean, be proud of what this industry does for California. But let me just also give us one statistics that As much as the administration and the legislature gave literally $300 million in relief funds during the height of the pandemic, $60 million, the largest single appropriation to the California Arts Council in the Creative Corps that John Moscone was just talking about and that we hope to see continue, $40 million for creative youth development. Lots of money has been put into what they would call relief to build back the workforce. We are now, the budget just got signed yesterday, at a place where we are actually 24th in local assistance ongoing funding in the United States in our state arts agency. And let me just throw this out there. We are behind Florida. Okay? All right? Yeah. So there is so much more work to be done here. And really, you know, we've also seen, I would say, what we're calling a crisis in the performing arts. And since the pandemic, let's be honest, there were some broken business models for this industry already prior to the pandemic, prior to AB5, et cetera. But really now we're seeing a crisis. Many of you probably read about the Mark Taper, you know, pausing their programming. I know that there's been things happening here in the Bay Area also where theater companies are shutting down, live venues are shutting down. We need to address this problem and we need to look at solutions. Some of those are in public policy. Some of those are in the co-op models and the ownership models and the solidarity economy that people are looking at and talking about and implementing. Some of it is in what Ralph Remington was talking about in terms of disruption of existing systems. But we really need to address some of these problems that are continuing and we don't want to lose this vital contributor to our communities. So that's part of what we do. We really try to build that narrative. We try to get you all to engage in this work. And let me just say this, that, you know, we send in a good year, 5,000 letters to the legislature. And that's an increase on what the organization used to do. We should be sending hundreds of thousands of letters talking about our impact. And so that is where all of you have to come in. And our job is to try and make it as easy as possible for you to engage in the work. So, you know, there's a lot more work to be done. We do see things are changing. We do see the influence happening. So grateful to have John at the helm of the Arts Council. It's going to make a massive difference. But, you know, there's still a tremendous amount of work to be done here in the state.
Thank you. And Jenny, turning to you. So Jenny and I met one of her wonderful breakout sessions. Her organization has nationwide data, and I'll let her tell you about it. But I asked her to come and try to provide kind of a statewide, but also a 9-county-wide perspective on data, because I think one of the things that performing arts organizations don't do a really great job of is grabbing data and using that data for growing the organization. So Jenny?
Yeah, absolutely. You are going to get all of the numbers that I'm going to look at on my phone to help you kind of contextualize where we are compared to 2019, right? That's where everyone's heads are at as far as data. Before I dive into the specifics, I had a friend the other day tell me that data is the language of the money. And I have not been able to stop thinking about that. I know a lot of artists don't really like numbers. They don't really find use in data, but data is the language of the money. And I think that is really powerful to think about how you talk about your impact, how you talk about not only your money, but numbers of people, right? Numbers is how you get the grants. It's how you get the governmental support. It's how you get the funders, right? So just one of the reasons why I'm kind of a proud data nerd is because I think it's really powerful. Pardon the Mickey sticker on my phone. My 5-year-old went to the doctor yesterday and got a sticker. Okay, so TRG, we published a study about 2 weeks ago that looked at the data from the past couple of years broken down by performing art genre. So you'll see, you can find this on our website, trgarts.com, or like I said, it's going to be in what George sends out after today. And we had been getting a lot of requests to look at the data by genre. So you'll see it's broken up by dance, performing arts center, theater, and music. And most of the music, there are symphonies and orchestras, things like that. Generally speaking, the lives of our dance companies and our performing arts centers are doing much better. The theaters are the ones that are still really struggling as far as ticket revenue goes, and so much so that they're still about 35% below the ticket revenue they were in 2019. Whereas for performing arts centers, we're seeing about 20% higher ticket revenue than they were seeing in 2019, about 18% higher for dance, and music is just about 5% down from where they were in 2019. And this is total ticket revenue, so subscribers, single tickets combined. If we look at donation revenue, unsurprisingly to all of you, probably, but none of that is better than it was in 2019. You'll see high ticks in the donation charts for 2020, 2021. Right, where people were really rallying around the arts and wanting to make sure these organizations survived. And none of that has been able to sustain this far. The other interesting thing, so if you look at ticket sales nationwide for all performing arts, we're still about 5% below where we were in 2019 as a whole. So 5% down in revenue, 17% down in ticket quantity. So that's an interesting comparison. So that average ticket price is significantly higher, which when I get to Bay Area data is really interesting because your Bay Area, that is not the narrative here at all. Your average ticket price is way lower than it was in 2019, which is interesting to me. There's more stuff in here about overall ticket revenue and donation revenue. I'm not going to go through all of it in this moment. But the other thing I want to point out is TRG were really, really big proponents of customer topology. So that's looking at recency, frequency, monetary, and growth. As far as how your relationship with your patrons, right? How recently are they coming? How often are they coming? How much are they spending? And is their loyalty and their spend with you growing over time, right? That's kind of TRG's big thing. We always joke that we're going to get the patron loyalty ladder. We're all going to get tattoos because that's like our big thing. But we like to look at all of that. And the interesting thing about where we are now is we're getting significantly more brand new customers than we've ever had. We, Arts and Culture Nationwide, right? Which is great. So whatever you're doing in marketing is working. It's getting new people in the door. The bummer flip side of that is the one-time returning customer typology is significantly lower. So you're getting more first-timers in the door, but even less people are coming back than they were in 2019. So that, I think, is a point of that I'm going to try and hammer home the rest of the day, is that new customer retention is something I think we really are underutilizing and underfunding and under-resourcing at this time. Another positive thing at the moment is demographically, we are seeing those new audiences make up more Gen Xers and more millennials than historically were coming, which is great. The bummer flip side of that is that they're not coming in significantly enough percentages to make up for the decrease in the baby boomer generation. We've lost about 25 to 30% of the baby boomers that just haven't come back since pandemic. And unfortunately, if you look at that customer typology, most of those baby boomers are going to be your loyalists, right? Your subscribers or people that were coming recently, they were coming frequently, they were spending money, and they were growing their support over time. So that dip in percentage of the baby boomer loss is really where I think we're all feeling the revenue strain at the moment. But yes, there are Gen Xers and millennials are coming, so we need to make sure that they come back and we need to reach more of them. One more thing about the Bay Area specific data that I thought was fascinating. And like I said, you'll be able to look at all of this and look at the specific numbers. But as far as ticket sales go, this has been, we had a really good holiday season mostly for ticket sales. But the thing that kind of shines in the Bay Area data specifically for me is you had a really good March and April. I don't know what goes on here in March and April, but apparently a lot that sold tickets. And that is a spike. I don't know if you can see the whole spike. But that's a spike that I'm not seeing anywhere else. So that's very Bay Area specific. I live in Los Angeles, so I'm not far away, but I don't know what's happening here in the early spring, but something exciting.
Is SF Travel in the room? I wonder if that's when they did their push, because they've been doing a lot of pushes with, anyway.
It didn't start until April 21st.
Shoot, Brenda. I wanted you to just take the credit.
I mean, claim it. Yeah, just own it. Yes, and then the other thing is the average ticket price is a really interesting story. And if I look at all of our markets where we have data that we're collecting, the Bay Area is the only market where the average ticket price is so significantly lower than it was in 2019. So that anecdotally is telling me that there are audience outreach efforts happening, and instead of skyrocketing a lot of tickets, that there are things happening in audience development. That would be my assumption. I would love to hear if that's the case. I'm curious. But I think that's all I've got for you, George.
So one question, Jenny, which I thought was interesting from our webinar that you hosted, was the demographic change in the type of performing arts. So could you share a little bit about the difference between a music versus a live theater performance?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of aligns with the demographic shifts generally with how well the genres are recovering, but it's basically what you would expect. So the performing arts centers are recovering faster and better, and they are seeing even a higher growth in the Gen X and the millennials that are buying tickets compared to the symphonies. The asterisk I would put on that is the ballet companies are doing significantly well, pretty better than the theaters or the symphonies are doing. And they, again, they do have some of that Gen Xer and that millennial energy coming, but they've got the Gen Z audience growing a little bit more than any other genre I've seen. It's still really tiny in the chart. You'll see it's like 7% or something, but it is. So there's something about the dance. And I don't know this for a fact. This is but I would admit it's because the ballet companies and the dance companies have a robust education pipelines built into their performing that might be why we're starting to see higher Gen X growth. There's a study not too long ago about adults are passionate about things that they were exposed to as a kid before they turn 11. So it's not about, which I thought was so fascinating. It didn't have to be their thing when they were a kid, but they were at least exposed to it before they were 11. So that's totally, that is not TRG knowledge. That is just my guess that all those dance companies and all those classes are getting into the brains early.
TikTok.
Thank you, Jenny. So, Vanessa, share with the audience, what's unique about ArtSpan is you work with individual artists. And so how has the pandemic really impacted the artists you work with? And then what do you see in coming back since 2021 going into 23?
Yeah. Okay. Hello, everyone. Yes, ArtSpan supports the individual artists here in San Francisco. During the pandemic, we did expand our services to more broadly serve artists who may not have been able to stay in San Francisco and had to go further into the East Bay, South Bay, North Bay. So currently we are, you know, our bread and butter remains our San Francisco artists, but we do extend some of our services to the greater Bay Area, and that includes San Francisco Open Studios. It also includes our professional development workshops and our networking mixers. During the pandemic, all of our programming shifted online into virtual, like many of us. But some of the things that we learned is because we're so community-based and we're membership-based, our artists really inform basically everything we do. And what we learned from them is that, you know what, we prefer professional development workshops to be online. We don't want to commute in, or I don't have time to go from the studio and then meet you at your space to hear something that is immensely valuable for my practice and my professional development. So that's one thing we've retained, is continuing to offer our career development workshops online. We also do occasionally some of them in person. We're exploring how to make them more accessible beyond what is available to us through Zoom and other online technologies. So it's something we're exploring, but this is one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is just learning new ways to engage and continue to engage our audiences and expand our audiences. Our individual artists, you know, it's interesting to frame it that way, that we serve the individual, but we're so community-based. I mean, it's just the things that we do, because we have such a broad network. We serve currently, I think, over 800 artists here within the Bay Area, and that allows this like progressive ripple effect. Our artists work with us to do public art initiatives that activate storefronts in San Francisco. We're very passionate about creating partnerships and uplifting the folks who are here in the city and have been here for a while. Some of the other things we did during the pandemic was activate parklets. We were very focused on windows, the windows that were able to remain open and not boarded up. We partnered with commercial corridors, specifically in the Excelsior for us. It's a neighborhood that we have some close ties with. We started a program there called the Excelsior Art Initiative. It began in 2018, And it's all about partnering artists with small businesses to create site-specific installations and that way create more exposure both for the business and for the artist. And also to revitalize those corridors that, you know, we all know that art can be very beautiful and very engaging and very inspiring. And that's something that seeing on your way to work or seeing on your way to run an errand can just completely shift the way that you're experiencing that day or like your mood, everything. So this is a really cool program that we've been doing. It's part of our Art in Neighborhoods program, which is basically putting art into unexpected places, not necessarily limited to galleries, which some folks can find intimidating to walk into and connect with art in that way. So we're looking at putting art in cafes and bowling alleys and, let's see, where else? Nick's out there. He's my right hand in doing all of this and works very closely with all the artists. But yeah, so activating underutilized space. And also that includes, you know, right now the Vacant to Vibrant program is something that we're like, wow, yeah, let's do that because we feel like we've kind of been doing that. So like, awesome that the city is wanting to fund that. And like, this goes back to partnerships and collaborations is really looking at not reinventing the wheel, but like, who's already out there doing that work and how can we partner to provide mutual aid and advance our shared needs? And I mean, there's so much. Like, I could go on. I know I have 5 minutes, but I do also want to talk about the role we all play in that. Yes, we're here as folks that support artists, and at ArtSpan, our team is very small. And over half of them are also creators in their own right. And it's really amazing that they're able to both maintain their own practice and also kind of put that aside to be to uplift others that are doing that. Like, I know there's hopefully a lot of artists out there as well that know how much time and how much effort, both mentally, emotionally, and physically, it is to maintain a creative practice. And so it's great that ArtSpan's able to create pathways for artists to have a full-time job and also put that good back out there to uplift their fellow artists. And we're very much focused on community engagement through the lens of art. Yeah, so I hope that answers your question.
That was good, and I want to circle back on, for folks in the room who may not know, and of course we're recording this as well, what is Vacant to Vibrant program?
Sure. So the Vacant to Vibrant program, it's not ArtSpan's program. It is part of SF New Deal. And from what I know about the program is they are creating leases with vacant spaces in the city of San Francisco. They're focusing on the financial district. If there's anyone here from SF New Deal that wants to chime in, please feel free. Yay! Thank you. And they're partnering with creative workers. They're wanting to put the creative workers into these spaces to reactivate them and revitalize neighborhoods that, you know, we have been hearing. There are little pockets of ghost towns here in the city of San Francisco. And so we all know that artists make things happen. Like, artists are great activators. And so what better use of those vacant spaces than to make them available to the creative workers that are here in the city and that know what the city needs and that are trying to stay here. So it's a really cool program. We want to partner with y'all. But yeah, that's Vacant to Vibrant through the ArtSpan lens.
Thank you.
You're listening to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, whose arts and culture grants ensure vibrant work is created, new voices are celebrated, and arts and audiences inclusive of the Bay Area's diverse communities and cultures have opportunities to thrive. To find out more, go to zff.org. And by a grant from the Peaceful World Foundation, dedicated to fostering a culture of global peace through the promotion of hosted conversations and education. You can learn more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Before we get back to our State of the Arts breakout session on the economic recovery of arts and culture organizations, we wanted to share an excerpt from one of our one-on-one interviews with the keynote speakers and summit guest that were conducted by our roving reporter team of Issa Nakazawa and Eric Estrada. Please enjoy more insights from Maria Jensen of Soma Arts Cultural Center.
I want to thank you because I really feel like as an artist who's living in the Bay Area and has for so many years, like over 20 years, it felt like the passion and the fire that I feel like has been missing from the conversation you've like channeled for all of us. So I just want to thank you because I feel like to your point that you were making that I want you to somewhat summarize about the power of narrative in the opposite direction where like we are starting to internalize the doom loop in narrative as people living in San Francisco and perpetuating it. So if you can kind of summarize that point around like what is something to be wary of around internalizing this narrative that the media has created and what is another narrative that we can kind of internalize or project out to combat that or to at least talk back to it.
Yeah, that's a very, very deep question. And I think it has to also do with how we are valuing artists and how we're valuing arts community and some of the smaller arts organizations. And so what I was trying to say here is that instead of us looking to tech or looking to some other corporate structure to find support and partnership, we need to recognize that we're the reason why these, you know, tech organizations and businesses want to come to San Francisco. Yes. So we are already here. We're the stakeholders of the community. And if anything, the partnerships need to go kind of in a different direction where businesses and corporations are asking how they can participate with what's happening in arts and culture here. So how do we find our voice? How do we change that narrative? And changing the narrative means we just need to go back and revisit San Francisco's history, its actual history of art, and including like so many artists that have emanated from here who have gone on to worldwide recognition. They are all grassroots artists that started here. And so San Francisco has this great ability to actually create a whole like generation after generation of incredible artists. And these artists are what is changing the world. Because art leads to open minds, and if we want to further the ideals of democracy, one of the most important things that we can do is make sure that the artists who are literally helping us to interpret our lives and helping us to see other lives and helping us to understand, these are the people that we need to be funding first and foremost, and we need to now get our business community to understand for capital, the biggest producer of you know what's been happening locally, surprisingly, the arts are a big production of revenue.
And are you seeing, I know you had mentioned at the beginning, like you've been going to the opera and the symphony and local events, like are you seeing and witnessing artists actually shift their understanding of their own value since the pandemic? Like, do you think the pandemic created that perspective for artists to really say, hey, I understand my worth and value, and I'm going to show up to, you know, the proverbial table with a different kind of sense of worth without being like defensive, but, you know, standing in our power. Like, do you actually see that translating, or do you think it's going to take time?
I think it's a couple of things. I mean, especially when you talk about the pandemic, because what we're talking about then is when we were all in isolation.
Yes.
And that isolation actually was something very beneficial in some ways because everyone got a chance to really think about what their lives mean, where the meaning is in their life, what the value is of their life. And so coming out of the pandemic, I think it's been very hard for artists because now they're kind of running into this narrative around the doom loop. And artists are, you know, very fragile, you know, people in our community because they're literally reading the cultural tea leaves for us. And so sometimes they're the first ones to actually see how things aren't going in the right direction. And so this is why I double down on the point that for any discussion of recovery or reimagining the city, it has to be done with the artists sitting centered at the table. And this idea around the doom loop is like, it's time for us to counter that with the joy loop. And so that's what I have been trying to foster, even in my own way.
Let's get back to our State of the Arts breakout panel discussion on how organizations are both innovating and iterating their structures and offerings to adjust to the changing landscape of a post-COVID world.
And Lauren, when you share with the audience for folks who don't know YBCA, which has been around for a while, you guys did an amazing job during 20 and 21 with regards to artist outreach. And then you also helped pilot the first universal basic income for artists here in San Francisco as well.
Well,
I recently joined Yerba Buena Center for the Arts this May. So one thing that I'd like to share about some of the work that we've been doing is really echoing a lot of the work that everybody's been talking about, in particularly around telling our story. And that's really important. Arts is so powerful. And so that ability to share that story, tell artists' stories in particular, what the amazing work that they're doing and how it impacts the community. That's one of the things that we've been doing for many years. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary. In addition, one of the things I think we also do really well as an organization is through partnerships, which we've talked about also. And I think really creating more partnerships with other arts organizations is really going to help us progress as a community, because we all have expertise in different areas. We have resources in different areas. We have friends in different areas. And bringing that all together collectively will allow us all to win. So again, we're working with a lot of partnerships. And I think the other area that's really important that we've been doing is around supporting artists also that we're talking about is the various different ways that we have started working with the city on rebranding. And I'm going to let my colleague Carrie talk more about that.
Thank you, Lauren. I think the story of YBCA over the last 3 years can be told a handful of ways, and the beginning of it might be in our neighborhood. And as an institution, we exist because of redevelopment programs in the city that converted our neighborhood into Yerba Buena Gardens and a bunch of other cultural institutions. And so we are partnering very deeply with some of Filipinas and others to try to determine what arts activation and arts investment looks like in the neighborhood. But again, we are trying to figure out a posture of humility with respect to that work. Much of that now looks like public arts programs that are going to begin and launch and be reinvested in over the coming years. But that's been a journey across the last 2 or 3 years. That's neighborhood driven. In the city, we partnered with the San Francisco city government on the basic income program, the guaranteed income program for artists. And while we're in a position right now to begin reflecting on that work, that was largely driven by pandemic relief and the idea of finding the neighborhoods and the places and the communities and artists that were most impacted and figuring out a livelihood strategy around monthly income for those artists. And we'll be doing, and the third is regionally, we've now been partnering with the California Arts Council on regranting programs, which look fairly similar. And those three layers, I think, are going to be told in a story that we're trying to step back from now and really look at as one common project that's been held very different ways by different leaders in our organization with different partners outside of it. And we're in a position now, maybe with an exhibition and maybe with some other work, of being able to step back and really talking about what the ecosystem work of San Francisco can look like and how Yerba Buena Center of the Arts, in a humble posture, can begin in the model of solidarity economy, partnering with the organizations that are best positioned to do that work and figuring out how to move the resources out of our building into the hands where they're needed most and figure out what work we hold best. And that's a huge reevaluation that we're undergoing right now because we're not necessarily always the organization best positioned to do that work. Part of that evaluation is because we as an organization through the pandemic also learned the hard lessons about what our business model isn't doing well. City funding got cut to a third. Our events program and our revenue program, our events program and our public arts program, performing arts program was shuttered in the way that every other performing arts program was shuttered. So as we come back, the only way through is in collaboration and solidarity with other organizations. The only way through is in identifying audiences that we haven't served yet. The only way through is recognizing that we were able to fill our theater this weekend for the first time in weeks because Dohi Lee and the Asian Refugee United organization, the artists from them, brought in a hugely diverse audience to the organization. So all of that has been a part of YBCA's DNA for the past several years, but it is the way through and out of the pandemic for not just the programs that we potentially laudably ran, but also the way we programmed the building ourselves. So all of it is we've been going through a big year of reflection about how that's going to look. I think in the coming year, you're going to see what that looks like in work. Amy Kish, Jody Cobalt, who run our arts and public programming and our performing arts programs are in the audience and could talk about what art is going to look like in the building. But it's going to be modeled very much through this idea that we are a canvas on which other people can come. We are a campus that we are building through partnerships with other organizations, and we are no longer going to be a monolith that tries to do this alone.
Thank you, Terry. Okay, so I'm going to open it up to Q&A for the audience, and Susie has the microphone. Since we are again recording this for TV show, radio show, and podcasts, please speak into the microphone and questions, not dissertations. So we're going to open it up for questions. Please raise your hand, and Susie will bring the microphone to you. And tell everybody in the audience who you are, what organization, or if you're an individual artist, what you practice. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Jeff Jones, and I am one of the co-founders of the Queer Cultural Center. And I was also the person that agitated for and successfully created the Cultural Equity Grants Program. And that was 30 years ago. And many things positive have happened there. But I do want to say that looking out at what's going on now in the local arts community, I was very impressed by the head of the Arts Commission telling us we needed to disrupt reality, because that's what most of us who were on the don't haves and the haves of 20 years ago, that's what we had to do. And I think it's finally paying off. But there are a few things that are really clear to me. The California Arts Council, while people talk about how wonderful it is, over the last 5 years or 7 years, instead of being supportive of individual artists and nonprofit arts organizations, have suddenly decided that what's needed is greater arts bureaucracies. And they've funded 60 of these state and local partners in all these counties that don't ever give a nickel to an artist. They pay for buildings, they pay for bureaucrats' salaries, but they don't get around to supporting artists. And that is a really terrible approach. And one of the tendencies that's very clear is that the California Arts Council, which was really the forerunner of multiculturalism in this state, has now become the captive of a bunch of arts bureaucrats, where now they're spending 25% on administrative costs. That's money that used to go to artists. And
I think
it's really different.
I don't want to interrupt you because your experience is incredibly valid. Can we bring it back to a question, though? Did you have a question for the panel?
Mike, I did have a statement that we should understand that whatever people are saying here, there is this tendency now to fund arts administrators instead of artists. And also, I don't mean to burst your bubble, but, the reputation of YBCA in this town sucks.
We know.
It always has. You've been around for 30 years.
Thank you.
And I hope you could do something.
Can I answer just very, very
sure.
responsively to this,
Go
which
ahead,
is,
Kerry.
As a bureaucrat and an arts administrator, we are concerned. I mean, the new leadership at YBCA, and we can't make any promises now about anything other than to say one of the things we're concerned with is the ways in which we sit between arts investment and the money that needs to be in community. Let me say it again. We are not meant to be holders of funds that are best spent by artists themselves or in communities that know how to put that money to better use. We're trying to model those practices through the programs and responsibilities we've taken on, and we're trying to look for the ways in which we can move that money as quickly as possible into community again now, even within the programs that we have. We are in an early assessment of all that work. Lawrence came on in May. I came on around the same time. So we represent an opportunity with Amy and Jody and others in leadership of trying to figure out how to get out of the way of being a siphon of funds in this respect. Yeah, I'm with you. And I think if there are people in our programs who've been working on the guaranteed income program directly and other programs who would say the same things that I'm saying in terms of what they've been learning, we're like months from being able to release some things that I think would be able to speak to the data from these programs and make it compelling for why we should get out of the way. But it is to say we also are stewards of space and are trying to figure out ways in which even that can be done through a position of solidarity and partnership where we are in a different position with respect to how we program. this is not going to be, I don't want to get into a divisive position right now on this at all, because like in San Francisco, whether it's housing, homelessness, or the arts, we can get very divided quickly. But there is a big part of us sitting downtown alongside a bunch of other big cultural institutions, holding space that many others could use just as well as we're trying to use it right now, that are trying to figure out how we open our doors and get out of the way of the scarcity that this feels as an artist to be alone in this community right now. I have nothing to say to you with respect that's concrete at all, other than as a human being to agree with you entirely with respect to the challenge. And that, like, entirely respect the challenge.
Thank you, Carrie. And then, you know, after the breakout sessions, folks, our speakers will be around. Hopefully they're going to hang out and have one-on-one conversation.
I'm happy to hang out, you and I.
There's an open bar as well, so you guys can chat it up. Our next question.
Hi. Can you all hear me? Okay, great. First of all, thank you for your time today. There is a lot of power on the stage and in this room, and I just want to honor that. Thank you. My name is Liz Luke. I'm the executive director for Living Jazz. I was also recently voted in. Julie, we haven't met in person, but I'm on your board now.
Can you speak up?
Oh, sure. Sorry. Does this not? Oh, I'll bite the mic. Okay. Sorry. Thank you. And in addition to that, I've been on the board for the Recording Academy. I'm currently on their advocacy committee. I'm a co-chair for the National Independent Venue Foundation's Emergency Relief Fund. And what I want to say is that I've done a lot of advocacy work on my own individually. I've done a lot of research, presented at city council meetings. I try to rally the troops in terms of getting artists to that microphone at city council meetings. It's incredibly intimidating to a lot of people, and a lot of the powerful voices in the room get really scared about how to even approach that, what to say, and what can we do with our policy minds here, our data minds here, and the amplifiers here to organize our artists better? Can we organize workshops online? I know for the Recording Academy, we have District Advocate Day, where we break everything down by chapter, where we with our congressional representatives or senators. There are team captains that are given talking points, many workshops beforehand on how to address it. We meet in cafes. We share artistic stories with our fellow comrades. And we go into that meeting super organized with an agenda. And it's incredibly effective. We're told it's one of the most effective lobbying efforts for artists. And I was curious as to, on this stage, in this room, how we could get together and have a meeting of the minds. We're talking about not being competitive for resources, but how do we grow the abundance of treasure we have here in California and the Bay Area in general? And I'm just wondering if you all have thoughts about how can we mobilize?
Who would like to take that?
I was just going to say the one thing that I think makes having those experiences with legislators now since the pandemic great is I hosted a couple lobby days recently from a past organization, and we were able to do that virtually. And we actually found it to be a lot more engaging because they actually sat on the phone with us and we had a group of people. So they felt it was less intimidating for the individual to speak because they had a group of people who were on the phone with them. So I do think there is some opportunity around that. And then they don't have to feel like they're face to face in front of the legislator. But I definitely think that's something that we would be interested in supporting.
And I would say, well, nice to meet you, Liz. We haven't met in person, but Liz just got voted onto our board, so I'm really excited, as well as Maria Jensen and Sean Fenton from TBA. So I'm really excited for Californians for the Arts. But I would say a couple of things. One is that we do Arts Advocacy Day, which just did in April. Maybe why numbers go up is April's Arts, Culture, and Creativity Month in the state of California. But, and so we do a lot of trainings throughout the year and try and engage people in advocacy. What we saw during the pandemic was that when everyone was out of work, everybody engaged in advocacy. And it worked. We got hundreds of millions of dollars in the state of California, and we got $16 billion for this SVOG, right? I mean, at the federal level. And that's because not only did the artists engage, the arts administrators engage, the patrons engaged, everybody engaged and said, we miss this, we need this. And although we've all been saying that forever, when it was actually gone, when it didn't exist, people missed it and recognized how much they needed it. Now what we're seeing is that people are going back to work, thankfully, and they're not engaging in advocacy at the same level. Now, in terms of artists specifically, I think that one of the things that we learned also is that you don't have to sound like me or us or someone who's talking about data to make your case. In fact, I think we are doing a disservice to ourselves in asking artists to sound like a lobbyist.
The most effective lobbying I've seen, actually, was a former board member of ours, Keisha Dumas Heath, who did, during the pandemic, we created an assembly hearing to talk about what was happening to the arts. And she did her testimony in the form of a poem. And it was tweeted out by all the legislators saying that was the most effective arts advocacy that they had seen. And it's because she used the arts, the voice of the arts, her practice to actually make the impact. And I think that that's one of the things that we're always looking at is, you know, how can we do, I mean, after the insurrection, right, you had the elected officials and their staff absolutely, the attempted insurrection, you know, devastated, right? I mean, traumatized by what was going on. Arts heal. Arts can really change people's, we know that's why you get up every day. We should have been delivering videos of dance performances and theater monologues and the poems that we heard earlier today and said, how can we help? How can we heal and transform your lives? I think that's how we engage artists in this work. We stop asking them to sound like a lobbyist and we say, utilize the practice to engage in the arts. Use your practice.
Thank you, Julie. Next question.
Yeah, and I think we have time for one more question. So I'm going to get this gentleman over here.
Hi, thanks so much for this presentation. I'm Christopher Cook, local writer and journalist. I guess my question is, how can we, it's kind of tagging on this other question, how can we develop more of a across the arts, including writing and, you know, literature and music and all the other arts, build more of a coalition to create, I love the talk about the storefront work that you're doing and, you know, how can we do more of that non-corporate development, kind of bringing back, you know, the keynote speaker talking about the Twitter tax break and that type of, you know, when I hear about how's downtown going to recover, sometimes my political alarm bells go off. Are we going to do more corporate-led development, or can this be a model, can this be a moment where we can actually create something fundamentally different, where the arts could be a huge leader? And I'll just feed into the question in case there's anything you can speak about this. Many of the folks who are hurting the most, homeless folks and poor folks in the SROs, in the Tenderloin and in South Market, many of them are artists as well. How can they be engaged and employed? Thank you.
Who would like to take that one?
I'll just say a couple things. One is that it's not a lack of money. The California budget is a $310 billion budget. We are soon to be the fourth largest economy in the world, taking over Germany. So it's not about that there isn't enough money. It is, where is the money going, right? It's a values, you know, your budget is your value. And so, you know, challenging whether it's the city of San Francisco's budget or Oakland or Berkeley or any of the greater Bay Area or the state of California and asking them, you know, where is the money going and really analyzing that. But in terms of, you know, building coalition, which is a critical piece in that we are representing ourselves as an industry, in my experience, has been very, very important to change the language to say we're not a cause, we're an industry. And we're an important industry to California. So I think I had something else I was going to say, now I'm forgetting. But wait, say your one, the question exactly again, what was?
How can we do non-corporate-led development in downtown and engage and employ?
So I think creativity hubs are something that we need to be thinking about. I work with inside of state government, so they think about things like innovation hubs, which is where you R&D technology, right? I think we need R&D creativity, and that's where artists come into play. And I think we need to actually create places for artists to be able to be creative, and we need to invest in that and not see that as a luxury or something only people who have access to generational wealth can apply to do. But everyone who has that actual amazing capacity should have the opportunity. So I think there are places where we could actually look at creativity hubs versus innovation hubs.
And I'd like to add a little bit more. Just from organizationally, from what we've seen at ArtsBan, is our biggest struggle, and this isn't a solution, but one of the things that we have the most trouble with is communicating out all of our opportunities. So we're a membership-based organization, but we are constantly thinking about, like, you know, we're already serving this population. How can we serve more? How can we expand and amplify what we're already doing? And, you know, every time a deadline passes for an opportunity, without fail, someone will reach out and say, well, why didn't I hear about that? Why, you know, I check off all the boxes. This was made for me. And like, we don't know. Like, and that's what we need support with. And so like, how do we amplify the opportunities that exist that like you referenced some of the programming we're doing that's activating storefronts. And a lot of that also includes like, we like to have receptions and community events to celebrate these partnerships. And so we seek everything from photographers to poets to musicians, and we're always focusing on investing locally. So we're trying to find the creatives here who are doing that work, and we don't always reach everyone. So some of the things we've been doing to try to mediate that is more like in-face, direct, like boots on the ground, going out into the neighborhoods. For us, it's the Excelsior right now, going and literally speaking to people in person. We're a small team, so we rely heavily not only on our staff, but also our committee members and our volunteers to help, you know, amplify this work. But it is a question we often ask ourselves is, how do we let everyone know, hey, we are paying, you know, X, Y, and Z, $1,300 for someone to activate this parklet. And we have 14 partnered businesses, and they really want a local artist. And sometimes we don't get all of those applications, so we can't activate all of those businesses. And we know that's ridiculous because we know there's hundreds, if not thousands, of artists here in San Francisco. So there is no reason that any business should not get partnered with an artist who can do that work and get paid for that creative labor. So all that to say is I don't necessarily have an answer, but I do feel strongly that our artists and our members and our community members here can help, you know, word of mouth, help us, or just tell us, like, you haven't done this yet. Like, why don't you do that? And, you know what? Yeah, hit us up. Tell us what we're doing, what we need to do, and just help spread the word as well.
Thank you, Vanessa. All right, so we've run out of time. We could obviously have this conversation for multiple hours. We're going to break, take a 10-minute break, come back, and then our next panel of experts, really wonderful group of people as well, is going to talk about economic recovery through the arts, which really riffs on what we've been talking about. So we hope to see you back in this room. Hopefully all of our speakers are going to hang out again, open bar, facilitates wonderful conversations. And there's, you know, after this next session, we're having a mixer/networking session. So we hope you stay around, spend time with our really wonderful expertise along with you guys and talk. All right. Thanks. Back in 10.
That's it for this episode of Voices of the Community. You've been listening to the voices of Julie Baker, CEO of Californians for the Arts and California Arts Advocates, Jenny Cohen, Data Analyst with TRG Arts, Vanessa Wilson, the Deputy Director of ArtsBan, and Lauren McMadieu, the Head of External Relations at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, along with Carrie McClellan, the Chief Operating Officer and In-House Counsel at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. To find out more information about our guests and their respective organizations' programs, services, how to volunteer, and to make a donation, please go to voicesofthecommunity.com and click on the link to the Arts and Cultural Series. While you're on our website, you can both watch or listen to the full episodes and one-on-one interviews of our Arts and Culture Series, along with signing up for our newsletter to stay up to date on future shows. After watching and listening to these wonderful stories, we hope that you will consider making a donation and volunteering to support our arts and culture organizations and our arts and culture workforce. Today's episode was made possible through our co-production partnership with Arts for a Better Bay Area for their state-of-the-art summit, along with our amazing technical crew, the audio and video wizard and our associate producer, Eric Estrada, and our co-production partner, Bayvac Media, and their wonderful staff, Paula Argoni, Andy Konami, Issa Nakazawa, Siobhan Giles, and Melanie Ayala. The graphics magic was made possible by Casey Nance from Citron Studios. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, whose arts and culture grants ensure vibrant work is created, new voices are celebrated, and artists and audiences inclusive of the Bay Area's diverse communities and cultures have opportunities to thrive. To find out more, go to zff.org and by a grant from the Peaceful World Foundation, dedicated to fostering a culture of global peace, the promotion of hosted conversations and education. You can learn more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. We'd also like to thank our broadcast partners, KSFP 102.5 FM, KPCA 103.3 FM, Petaluma Community TV, and BayVac Media.